Good morning once again, Vermont. Lee Cattell here at the lavish Radio Vermont studios for Vermont Viewpoint here on WDEV. Throughout the next 2 hours, your phone calls are invited if you want to offer up questions or comments to our guests at 802-244-1777. Toll free from everywhere, 1-877-291-8255. On the way today, Mark Isselhart from UVM Extension, our Maple Minute guy, will be giving us a recap of the season in sugar making. Colin Flanders of 7 Days will talk about a latest report out about the demographics situation in the state of Vermont. And Bob Ney at the top of the 10 o'clock hour will join us with a conversation about national and international issues here on WDEV. Our opening guest this morning is David Berg, the new president of Vermont State University. And good morning, David. Thanks for joining us here on Vermont Viewpoint today.
Good morning, Lee. It's delightful to join you. I'm glad to join you. And I have to say, if I had known your studio was lavish, I would have made an extra point of trying to get there in person. So maybe next time I can get there directly rather than calling in.
Well, my first thought was, oh, you have no idea. And then my second thought was, yes, you absolutely have to get into this studio. It will be a singular experience, and I guess I can leave it at that.
Okay, great.
Hey, this is the first full year of Vermont State University. How successful has it been?
Yeah, well, I think it's been really successful. It's been an exciting and exciting year, and we've had all the normal growth pains you would have when you're the first year of an institution. But I have to say, as we're approaching our first commencement in just a few short weeks, the mood on campus reflects the weather today, which at least here in Randolph is pretty sunny here at the moment. I think we're really excited to be heading into our first commencement. We're seeing really good energy in terms of the way our programs are being received around the state. We're really trying to actively meet those workforce needs of Vermont, and we're seeing the positive initial indications of growth on the horizon, with a lot of piqued interest in this next enrollment cycle of applicants. So we see a lot of positive indicators on the horizon. So really excited to be here at this time with Vermont State.
Everybody's talking about numbers of enrollment as a key factor for Vermont State University. What do those numbers look like both now and spinning ahead to next year?
Yeah, great. Yeah, you're right. I mean, that is ultimately what people look at as an indicator of the health of the institution. We met our enrollment targets the first year coming in for VTSU, but I think obviously we want to be growing in order to be best serving Vermonters. And, you mentioned in your lead-in, one of your upcoming guests later today, I'll have to see if I can get back on the line to listen, is going to be talking about demographics within the state of Vermont. So within the really challenging environment that the Northeast particularly faces, with the traditionally aged population, we know we need to bridge beyond those students. We need to be drawing in more students from out of state and out of the region, and I think Vermont's a big draw for students from around the country, and we need to be looking at students at different points in their lives who want to be going back and earning a credential or earning more skills. So pursuing all of those groups, we're seeing some early positive indicators as we look at year-over-year data. We're seeing an overall increase in applications, both in-state and out-of-state, as we head into the fall, increase in admits, increase in preliminary commitments. And interestingly, we're even seeing an uptick in our inquiries for the 25-26 cycle, so a year beyond next year compared to year over year. So I think the messaging is getting out there, and it seems to be resonating.
There's been a couple of changes in the curriculum at Vermont State University, and the multi-year nursing program has, what's been the draw for the nursing program so far?
Well, I think the nursing program, there's a number of things that make it a popular draw. One is, well, for one thing, that it's producing students into careers that are greatly in demand in the state, that are meeting a state need, and that are high paying jobs. But I think, yeah, we're undergoing a major multi-year expansion of the nursing program to allow us to double the number of students enrolled in that program to get it up to about 1,000 students. And I think the things that really connect for students are the flexibility of those programs. I mean, offering them all around the state. We have 15 sites statewide, so we're all the way from, you know, Brattleboro and Bennington up to Newport and just about every place in between. So we're really trying to reach Vermonters where they are, and we're partnering with regional hospitals, with the UVM Health Network, to look at ways to really help students have access to these programs at whatever point they are in their lives. So, you know, we have a laddered approach. There is a traditional 4-year bachelor's of nursing program at Castleton, but students can also do what we call the 1+1+2 program, and that can be done at any of the other locations across the state where they can get an LPN in year one, their RN in year two, and then after years 3 and 4, get their bachelor's degree. And we've also just recently launched a master's in nursing program with the first cohort in that currently. And that's in part because, you know, we see the need at every place in the cycle around nursing, because just as there's a need for more nurses, there's also a dire need for more nursing instructors. So we're trying to address that. And by doing that and working with partners, including regional hospitals, we're really seeking to give students the opportunity to complete this work on their own time, often at the workplace in conjunction with their employer. The average age of the student in that program is 30. So these are students at different stages in their lives and careers.
They could be folks who might have been looking in a different direction and seen maybe not as much opportunity popping up there. So reorienting toward a profession where there would seem to be plenty of opportunity for positions going forward.
No, absolutely. You're right on both of those fronts. I mean, we see a lot of students who are making, you know, midlife career changes or, you know, had a job that they maybe want to see a new career, have more fulfillment. And to that second point, the jobs are out there. So, I mean, that's the other thing. It's a really smart place to invest your time and studies and energy. If you have a passion for working with people in that setting, it's a rewarding profession, but it's also a well-paying profession, and it's a profession that's in demand. So you will find a job in the state of Vermont when you come out of these programs.
Well, it's a challenge for the college age student right now, number one, to find a line of training and a profession to be developed that will carry them through a good portion of their professional career, and being able to complete college without being buried in massive amounts of debt. And
right,
that's kind of a fine line for you to run, David Berg.
Yeah, it certainly is. It certainly is. And I think we are really focused on affordability, of keeping our programs affordable, and of assuring that we're aligning our programs with the workforce needs in Vermont so that our students coming out of these programs are finding jobs that are fulfilling and rewarding to them, but that are also meeting the needs of the state. And so I think there is a balance to be struck there. You mentioned the fine line, because I think a lot of what we do in the traditional liberal arts is really important in terms of a skill set that will enable students to be prepared for many different careers in their lives, because we know in this day and age, a lot of folks pivot, as we were just discussing, within their lifetime might have several different careers. So those broad-based skills are important, but we're also, you know, looking at growing high-demand programs. You know, we talked about nursing, but we also have some really thriving apprenticeship programs, plumbing and electrical apprenticeship programs, which have really grown rapidly. So again, striking that balance and finding the curriculum and the programs that students want and that are pertinent to them, but also are going to position them for long-term success in Vermont.
We're talking with Vermont State University President David Berg here on WDEV. The phone number, if you've got a question or comment, 802-244-1777 or toll-free 877-291-8255. Dave, you blew through that 112 idea pretty fast, and I didn't quite absorb it all. Would you move through that a little bit slower? Because it sounds like the 112 part of the nursing program might be able to give people an opportunity to be learning on the job while they're learning their skills in the classroom.
Yes, absolutely, and thank you. There is a lot in there, so I'll slow it down here a bit because I don't want this to get missed. I think we call this the laddered approach, meaning we have built in a program in which students can earn a series of credentials as they progress in their work and as they're in the workforce. So while they're working with this 112 program, they can, after the first year, earn the LPN credential. They can be an RN after year two and then earn a bachelor's degree in nursing upon the completion of the four-year program. And all of those are designed – and those credentials, not everyone is needing to or wanting to progress all the way through those. So different credentials might meet the needs of individual students at different places and times in their lives and careers. But what the way we've structured this is that if students want to continue to advance their career and to add to their learning and background, they can do so, and they can do it over a period of time in conjunction, again, with their employers with that flexible path. And then the master's program, which I noted, is the most recent addition to that and is really aimed at again, helping to address the need for instructors in nursing programs and folks who can then help us in building, reinforcing and building the pipeline in the nursing profession. And I should note that it's over 80%. I think 83% was the last number I saw of our nursing graduates are licensed to practice here in Vermont after earning their degrees. So, again, you can be living here, going to school here, working here, and advancing your career all of while staying in Vermont, which I know is really important and is a key goal and objective for us.
David, as we went into the break, you mentioned a plumbing and electrical apprenticeship program. And I think it seems to me to be a great idea because a lot of our electricians and plumbers and contractors are part of that demographic trend where there's a lot of experience in this area that is moving out of the workforce. And these are the types of jobs, being a plumber or an electrician, once you know how to do that once, you're pretty much, you have a career that you can turn to basically for your entire life.
Yeah, absolutely. Not unlike nursing, right? Like we were just talking about high-paying jobs and jobs that are always going to be in demand and in need. And you're absolutely right to identify that as a sector where a lot of folks are retiring or leaving that after a long career. We need to make sure the next generation of folks are ready to step in and do that work here in Vermont. And so we have seen a huge growth in the plumbing and electrical apprenticeship programs this year, and it reflects the fact that there's a critical need across all sectors of the workforce in Vermont. And again, similar to what we were talking about with nursing, students in these programs often work for local employers, you know, during the day and then study a few nights a week. And so they're earning wages even as they're increasing their skills. And that's really the model we're looking at across the board. And I should note, you know, my appreciation to the partnerships we've developed with industry and with businesses in doing this work with all of our programs. I mean, it's the Vermont way, I always say, is we need to work together. So, you know, I mentioned the hospitals earlier, but also, you know, every employers in the tech field, I think of Beta Technologies, Global Foundries, all the way to, you know, Kingdom Trails. I mean, these are all examples of the types of businesses where we have internship and growth opportunities. And so, bringing it back to plumbing and electrical, I think, again, another great example of a credential you can earn while you're working in the field and, working in flexibility with local employers.
And as far as the university itself, is it possible that part of this program is to take some of these apprentices and actually have them do some real-life work on the physical plant at the university?
Yeah, I would love to see more of that as we move forward. I mean, you mentioned physical plant, and that kind of takes me down a whole other road that I could talk about for probably a half hour, which is really the work that we're doing within our campus communities to envision the future of our physical campuses and look at ways to make sure we're maintaining five vibrant campuses. And in doing so, I think there are going to be all the more opportunities to really do some creative and exciting things with our partners in the regions that these campuses serve, with local agencies and businesses, to really think about how we can have more presence for other functions that support our students on our campuses in ways that also benefit the local communities, because I want our campuses to really be a resource and to serve the regions that they're located in. And I think folks aren't always aware that when you look at the location of our campuses, that these campuses, when the system as it was at the time was created, they were very intentionally located to be anchors and to serve regions and to be access points for education in parts of the state that had been traditionally underserved. So we take our role in the community really seriously, and if there are more things we can be doing to partner with the communities, we want to do that, including, to your example, having students in our programs be able to get hands-on experience in ways that are beneficial to the campus itself.
Yeah, that would be a win-win situation there for sure. Another thing that I'm considering here is, As a college president, it is your job to find those careers that are going to have some lasting power. Are you looking at the artificial intelligence field? All right, so let me give you a story. The engineer here at the radio station said, "Hey, Lee, check this out," and he sent me a little link. And what he did was, he goes, "I contacted this artificial intelligence firm and gave them three stories. And they turned it into a 2-minute broadcast, and it sounded just like my voice, and I didn't do any speaking in it. It just artificial intelligence created the whole thing, and it kind of sounded like a guy giving a newscast. Although, you know, it was still a little choppy. The technology's a little early, but I'm thinking, oh, there goes my job." Or, you know, there is technology that is going to make a lot of things that people do now being done by an automatic machine. So that must prevent a tremendous challenge for you to say, oh, in this occupation, 5 years from now, that's going to be obsolete. How are you looking into these places to make sure that you're not leading students down a road that somewhere along the way, technology is going to say, we don't have any use for you?
That it's a great question. There's so much that could be said about this. I mean, one of the things that I always say in reference to the liberal arts foundation of our education is, you know, it's important to develop a broad skill set that will be useful and transferable regardless of what you're doing in the future, because we know for some students in, you know, that are maybe in junior high right now, that the jobs that they will inhabit someday potentially don't even exist yet, right? We might not even be able to envision what some of those jobs may be. I think with AI, there's a real opportunity for this to be an incredible resource for us, and there's also a lot of risk and a lot of uncertainty and things we don't know. And, you know, yes, it's going to dramatically change the employment field. There are jobs that can be automated, but there are also going to be plenty of places where you know, human ingenuity is going to be required. And so that's, I do think the place where we continue to be incredibly important and relevant is because those skills, the things that AI won't be able to do are the things that we're helping students develop. But we are convening a day-long retreat, I know, here on our campuses in the summer for our faculty and staff, specifically about AI and around kind of looking at AI and how to harness it in its current iteration to our maximum benefit and interest, and to really be thinking about how we see it affecting us in the future. And you know, and we've all seen Terminator, or most of us have seen Terminator, so obviously that's the direction we want to avoid. But I think that there's all kinds of potential there, and much yet to develop.
You mentioned Global Foundries and Beta Technologies as two companies that you're partnering up with. For those companies, what sort of skills are they expecting Vermont State University to develop in their students?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, obviously with those examples, developing the tech and engineering and math and science foundations and skills that are directly pertinent to that work are critical components of it. But in those fields, just like any other, again, the broad-based skills that we're developing, again, through kind of a liberal arts foundation that supports that more tech and scientific specific field work is critical to that work as well. But yeah, they have some, and obviously, you know, what we are providing is a foundation that then employers build upon in terms of their training with the very specific components required for their individual lines of work. But what they need is that gap to have students who have enough foundation to be able to come in and be trained and not be starting from scratch.
You said five campuses, of course. Are you located near one of them? Which one is basically your home base?
Yeah, Randolph Center is where I am this morning, and that's my home base. Although any given week, I'm usually on at least one or two of the other campuses. Earlier in my career, I spent 19 years on the Johnson campus, so I'm obviously very familiar there, and I'm familiar with and spend as much time as I can on all of our campuses. I think they all have their own distinct histories and cultures and identity, and that's something we want to preserve while also having each of them reap the benefits of being part of a larger university and the resources and support that can bring to bear.
I didn't realize you were a Johnson guy. I cut my teeth in radio at WJSC.
Oh my goodness!
Yeah,
oh my goodness! Yeah. You and many other folks I've connected with since my return to Vermont, so that's great. I worked very closely with students at WJSC in my time there.
Thankfully, there's no archives of any of that work remaining, I don't believe. When I was in high school, we used to be able, as high school kids, to gather up and play pickup games at the Johnson State College Gymnasium. Is that still possible, or is access a little bit more restricted to the public now?
We're trying to make sure all of our facilities are maximum available to the public, obviously within any of the current safety and security guidelines. But no, pickup games are still very much possible and encouraged.
David Berg, the president of Vermont State University, I really appreciate your time. It was an education in about 20 minutes here on WDEV. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Glad to do it again, and have a great day.
Welcome back. Vermont Viewpoint, WDEV, FM and AM. Lee Cattell here with you, and open phones until 10 o'clock. In the next hour, Bob Ney with National Issues, Mark Isselhart with a Maple update, as this season, it was kind of like the ski season. Started slow, didn't really kick in. People wondered if we were going to get much of a year, and then pop at the end. Got a lot of weather and a lot of sugar made over the course of the final stretch of the season. And just like those big snows helped to rescue the ski season here in the state of Vermont, it looked like a similar sort of thing unfolded. We'll see if Mark Isselhart agrees with all that when he joins us at 10:15. And 10:30, Colin Flanders from 7 Days will talk about the latest report about the demographics issue in Vermont. Yeah, we know we're all getting older. That may be true, but it beats the alternative. You can join me if you got something you want to sound off on. Open phones from now until 10 o'clock right here on the stations of Radio Vermont, WDEV, FM, and AM. You are invited. There are a number of efforts going on downtown Montpelier trying to boost the spirits of the folks downtown. VT Digger had a report this morning saying that a lot of the businesses in downtown Montpelier got a little bit of a pop from the folks who came in from the eclipse, but businesses are still struggling in the downtown. The Montpelier Bridge put out this story just earlier this week that many of these downtown businesses are seeing a decline in foot traffic that's being attributed to more remote work. The closed hotel, the Capitol Plaza that just recently opened, and the closed post office and fewer open businesses are slowing things in downtown Montpelier. The executive director of Montpelier Alive said it's a huge concern since COVID and then the flood. Montpelier's experienced quite a decrease in visitors to shops and especially restaurants and cafes. Melissa Bounty of the Central Vermont Economic Development Council was tracking local businesses and their finances, 9 of them in Montpelier. She said, "These businesses allowed us to see their finances today and for the past 5 years. And in January of this year, she said, we found that the net revenue of these businesses was off 50% on average compared to January of 2019. That is a very sharp drop in revenue compared with the sharp increases in costs in downtown Montpelier. Businesses and organizations in the city working to bounce back from the flood. Stores and restaurants are reopening. The recent reopening of the Capitol Plaza should boost the downtown. The Green Mountain Film Festival and the Eclipse brought some people in. But overall, business has not been very good in recent months, according to Katie Trouts of Montpelier Alive and others. And so they're struggling in the downtown area. Businesses are wondering what's going to happen to the state's buildings and the workers there long term, who are a pretty good source of business for the downtown areas. And private businesses and nonprofits are also moving to working remotely, and that also has watered down some of the downtown traffic in the capital city. Local business owner disappointed that the House declined recently to add money to the state budget to help businesses recovering from the flood. Flooded businesses were given $20 million last summer and fall, and there were hopes that another $40 million could be added through the budget to the state's Flood Recovery Assistance Program. Connor Casey, a Montpelier Democrat representing the capital city, said studies have shown the flood caused $300 million in economic injury in central Vermont. He said, although it appears no more state funding for flooded businesses is likely to materialize this year, he says he'd like to see the state set up an organization or program that could seek grants and federal funds for those businesses. An effort to do this failed in the House recently, but Casey hopes the idea could be revived in the Senate before the legislative session adjourns. Well, there are plenty of issues going on in Montpelier for sure, including this so-called effort for tax relief in the state of Vermont. But a lot of people are taking a look at it and saying, I don't see a whole lot of tax relief in there. And the governor's administration and the state house are going back and forth over what the best approach will be as we try to get a handle on education costs in the state. And there was quite a bit of back and forth on that yesterday. And we'll talk about that in just a minute. But right now, let's go to the phones. Homer in Williamstown, good morning. You're on Vermont Viewpoint.
Hey, how you doing today?
I'm doing great, Homer. How are you?
I'm good. Hey, I got a question for you. Now that Steve Cormier is gone, are you station manager now?
Yes.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you very much. I am an interim manager of the station.
Well, that's what's that? Working manager?
Yeah, I'm the operating manager. I'd like to have some of my obligations delegated out, and all that will come within time. But right now, the ownership is handling the money, and I'm dealing with making sure we're on the air every day. Actually, our engineer does all that, and I just ask the people to come in.
I'm just glad to see you move up.
Oh, well, thank you for that. It's been a long, slow process here at Radio Vermont, but yep, I'm moving on up.
Well, that's good.
Hey, thanks, Homer. Anything else you want to add on today?
No, that's all I wanted to ask you.
Well, I appreciate it. Yep, I'm live and well and right here at WDEV. I love this radio station. I don't want to go anywhere. I think this is a true asset to folks around the region, and I don't want to go anywhere. I've always said I'm just about unemployable at any other radio station anyway. WDEV fits me. It fits a lot of our listeners, and I'm happy to be with you here every day. So, you know, that's what that is. And, Corm and the departure from Radio Vermont Group has kind of moved me up to, I guess, the general manager of this station. And, you know, we just keep doing whatever needs to be done to keep it on the air here on WDEV. And, you know, we'll let all that other detail stuff figure it out as we go along. 244-1777, toll-free 877-291-8255. That's the number to join me here on WDEV. So back to this tax story here. $2 billion for the statewide education fund. That means that the state is now paying more for education than they are for the rest of state government. It's the first time that that has ever happened. And here's what Cornwall House Democrat Peter Conlon had to say about that.
The issue is very complicated. That's just not a trite thing to say. It really is.
Yeah. Well, being complicated, it's actually a very simple problem for Vermonters. The education costs too much. What's complicated is figuring out for the House lawmakers to figure out which of the – I mean, so many of what goes into education spending is mandatory. So there are things that they have to do that cannot be removed out, and a lot of that is driving up the costs. Plus, this idea that COVID money that's not available anymore, that rings a little hollow to me, really. I mean, they knew that the COVID money was not going to extend forever, and all the school districts should have been operating with that in mind. That seems like a very hollow excuse to say we had COVID money and now we don't anymore. Nobody should have been surprised by that. Everybody should have understood that that was how it was going to be. And pointing to that as a reason why it's so hard to balance a budget right now, well, that seems seems like they're trying to complicate things that some of these things are pretty simple. The yield bill approved by the House Ways and Means Committee yesterday would raise about $27 million through new taxes on short-term rentals and business software as an effort to offset a fraction of the $200 million increase in school spending.
You are seeing the culmination of some really tough decisions coming here today to make sure that we get it right and we don't have any unintended consequences for what we want to do.
Now, that's Democratic House Speaker Jill Krawinski. And how to make sure there are no unintended consequences of a law passed, I don't know how you do that. How you can pass a law and expect to understand every single consequence that will come out of that law, I think she's asking for something that really cannot be done. And we've seen this over the past couple of years where laws have been passed, and then what do you know? We've got a big spike, or they tried to limit property taxes, and the next thing you know, school districts are spending more. Everything they try to do has seemed to produce a result that hasn't been what taxpayers would like to see. So Krawinski, flanked by lawmakers and school administrators, announced they're forming a group to study the issue and come up with a new school funding formula in a couple of years. So forming a group to study the issue, that's another expense. And coming up with a new funding formula in a couple of years implies that there's no real urgency to solve a problem that is an urgent problem to a lot of Vermonters out there who are like older folks, limited income, not many opportunities to increase your revenue. So you're looking at school funding going up, not much you can do about it. And lawmakers are saying, well, we're going to try and figure this out a couple years down the road. Republicans yesterday blasted Democrats for not developing a plan this year. Here's Scott Beck, Republican from St. Johnsbury.
And then we say we're not even going to make any changes to the system. We're just going to do the same thing again next year. I just think that really lacks leadership.
Governor Phil Scott agreed with that assessment. He blasted the Democrats' plan and threatened to veto the yield bill, saying the House's only plan is to accept an unbearable property tax increase without any cost containment while adding other taxes and studying the problem for a couple of years. As school budget votes and revotes continue to fail, Brattleboro Democrat Emily Kornheiser sympathized with the schools and told Vermonters they need to support them.
This is a moment. Schools are under tremendous pressure. We need to make sure that we are supporting them as we work towards a more sustainable future together.
Mm. Well, yeah, that doesn't sound like there's any efforts going on there to lower costs. What Representative Kornheiser implied was we need to support these schools and continue to pay these rising property tax bills until the folks in Montpelier can figure out how to lower costs for us. That sounds like I'll give you a hamburger. I'll pay you Tuesday for a hamburger today. I'm not sure I'm buying that argument from Representative Kornheiser. The full House is expected to vote on the yield bill next week, and then it will head to the Senate. Any big changes in the bill remain unlikely. Welcome back from Our Viewpoint, WDEV FM and AM. I'm about 8 minutes from the top of the hour, and special guest joining me right here, Vivian Ladd-Tomasi, is the project coordinator for Montpelier Alive's Bridge Illumination Project. And Vivian, thanks for joining us here on Vermont Viewpoint today.
It's great to be here.
Now, this is a big community effort. Last year in the pilot project, Langdon Street Bridge got lit up. Talk about the work that went into it and how the town responded.
Well, the bridge lighting on Langdon Street was part of our seasonal lighting campaign, and we felt strongly that if we wanted to light a number of historic bridges, that we needed a pilot project to test the experience and to see how the community responded. And the response was overwhelming. In particular, the businesses on Langdon Street were so appreciative that the bridge called attention to their businesses that had just reopened after the flood. That street is traditionally quite dark, and people were avoiding it after the flood and assuming that none of the businesses were open. Ooh. But the minute that bridge was lit, as one bartender at Bent Nail said, the bridge was everything. It signaled that there was so much fun happening downtown, that it made a real difference.
Well, that sounds like a great pilot project. So an expansion in store?
Absolutely. So we are actively fundraising and looking to donors, and we are engaged currently in a crowdfunding campaign to light perhaps up to 7 bridges along the North Branch and Winooski River. We don't want this project to cost taxpayers anything. There's a lot of money out there for revitalizing downtowns and energizing downtowns. So we're looking to those funds to build electric infrastructure for the project and then to hire a professional lighting company to animate those bridges in a way that's just beautiful and tasteful and in keeping with the spirit and the brand of our downtown.
Wow. 7 bridges in Montpelier. That must be just about all of them.
Well, no, actually, I think there are something like 23 highway, railroad, pedestrian, and car bridges in Montpelier. We are truly a city of bridges. Yeah. But the seven bridges we've identified are the ones in the historic downtown. They're all gateways to the city or part of our commercial center. And the goal is to attract visitors and residents into our recovering downtown, to signal our recovery and resilience, to increase pedestrian safety, and just to create a magnet in Montpelier as the capital city.
So you want to raise more than $16,000 by the end of May. How's it going so far?
Well, we've had an overwhelming response to our crowdfunding campaign. We were fortunate to receive a grant from Better Places, which is a state granting organization to create dynamic downtowns. And that's a 2-to-1 match. So if we raise that initial amount of money, they will double that and donate that to our project. And that represents about half of our budget. We also have several other grants in play. So the Better Places grant and the crowdfunding will allow us to build the electric infrastructure that we need and to light the North Branch bridges. And we really, really hope that organizations like AARP and grant funders like Animating Infrastructures will help us light up the Winooski bridges, and in particular, the 2 truss bridges on the Winooski that will be so spectacular when they are outlined in light.
So the fundraising campaign is off and running, and you're not there yet, so you're still looking for folks to come on in and donate.
Absolutely, absolutely. They can find the site if they just Google Montpelier Bridge Illumination or Montpelier Bridge Lighting. It should come up, and you can just donate right on the website, or you can contact Montpelier Alive if you'd like to send a check to Montpelier Alive. Any and all of these opportunities are there to donate. We are really hoping to cross that finish line very soon so that we can turn our attention to the Winooski River and raising the money for those bridges through grants.
And if they reach their goal of just a hair over $16,000, a grant of more than $26,000 will arrive to contribute. The three bridges for the downtown, the Rialto, Langdon, and School Street bridges. Any remaining funds will also light up the bridges on Bailey Avenue, Taylor Street, and two bridges on Main Street. You can find out more about that bridge project at MontpelierAlive.com/bridges. And Vivian, one more time, if you'd direct folks on where they might go to make that contribution.
Okay, so just one small correction. The four bridges on the Winooski are the Bailey Avenue, Taylor Street, Main Street, and hopefully Granite Street.
Okay.
And you can Google Montpelier Alive. You can find a connection there, or you can simply Google Montpelier Bridge Illumination Project, and our crowdfunding website should appear, and you should be able to donate right there.
So if we reach June 1st and you've hit your goal, when may we expect these bridges to be lit?
The bridges will be lit in mid-November, and they will stay lit until mid-February. We are going to have a huge celebration in November. We're going to have a lighting ceremony. We hope to have a lantern parade. There's a big educational component to this project, learning more about the histories of the bridges and our relationship to our rivers. We're going to have lantern-making workshops. It's going to be so much fun. So the lights go on in November when the skies get dark.
And you're looking for donations and grants. You are not looking to the State House for any state-funded support for this project.
Well, not beyond grant-funded initiatives that are designed to energize downtown. The Better Places Project is a state. Funding initiative,
right?
But we are not looking to the citizens of Montpelier or to the city of Montpelier to underwrite any of these costs. This is all grant funded and crowdfunded.
MontpelierAlive.com/bridges is where you can find more about the illumination project in the capital city, and the crowdfunding campaign is underway. Vivian, I appreciate you showing up on very short notice and giving us all the important information about this project. Thanks for the time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. And let's light up Montpelier, everybody.
There we go. That's Vivian from the Montpelier Alive Bridge Illumination Project here on WDEV, here on Vermont Viewpoint. If you miss it live, the Vermont Viewpoint podcast is available on our website, WDEVradio.com.